This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good morning, Rutherford County. You probably heard Dan Whittle this morning. He's sitting here with us with Mr. Andy Downs. And I tell you what, this is going to be a show that you can't miss because you're going to be riveted on the side of your table while you're sitting there listening, those of you that are out of bed already. And it is one of those shows that only on radio can you really get the true sense of what's going on, the emotions that are happening. And I know your imaginations are going to be running wild this morning. And we want to let you know that the first part of Andy's show is brought to you by Murfreesboro Automotive. When you need car repairs, you want someone you can trust. Murfreesboro Automotive is that place. Chuck Haynes has a staff of certified technicians that can fix anything. And from the simple oil change to major auto repair, Murfreesboro Automotive is the only place you need. Murfreesboro Automotive, turn off Broad between Chewy's and Chili's on to Ridgely Road. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, it is a great pleasure for me because what you've gone through is something that nobody else wants to ever experience. It's one of those things that when you look at things that are totally out of your control and you're facing the ultimate challenge, I don't think there is anything else that can make you feel as helpless as what your dad went through back in the early, 1971 it was.
Yes, it was October 4th, 71. You know, he was just a simple guy who was doing something that he had striven for his entire life, to be a commercial pilot. And he was working out of the Nashville airport. And like all charter pilots, on his day off, he got a call to haul some people down to Atlanta. Supposed to leave just a little bit after midnight. And things just kind of got out of hand from there. After midnight, at the old Hangar 7 at Nashville Airport, he and his co-pilot were sitting there waiting for his passengers. And this car pulls up, this big Cadillac. You've got two great big guys in it on the front bench. And in between, there's this woman screaming that she's being kidnapped.
Wow.
And to please God, help her. And as my father and his co-pilot are sitting there watching this scene, the driver gets out while this girl is being restrained in the front seat. This main man, the driver, his name was George Giff, walks over to my father and his co-pilot and says, "We're ready to go," in a very calm way. And in the background, you've got all this screaming and fighting going on. My father goes, "Hang on, Chief. She's in hysterics. She is saying she's being kidnapped. And there is no way we're going to put everybody in a small airplane like this. This just isn't safe. We need to, you know, let the police figure this out." And he goes, "Don't worry about it. I'm a doctor. I'm taking her to Atlanta for treatment." And my father goes, "Do you have any credentials?" And at that point, he pulled out a gun. Now, about that same time, this girl who was struggling and being restrained in the car by a man by the name of Bobby Wayne Wallace, she flung herself away from him and out the driver's side door that had been left open by Giff. So he runs over, picks her up by the hair off the concrete, and drags her to the airplane. And Wallace gets out of the car with his pistol, a 9mm pistol, and helps wave my father and his co-pilot onto the airplane. And they start up and taxi out. And at this time, one of the airport workers had run into the hangar to call airport police. the airport police station was not very far from the runway that they were scheduled to take off on. So they got there relatively quick, but just not quick enough to cut off the airplane. And ended up following my dad's airplane, two cars with blue lights flashing, chasing them down the runway, and watched them take off. And as soon as they got up in the air...
At this time, had anybody ever hijacked an airplane in this particular area, or have they ever had one that may have been used as an example of how to take care of the situation?
The answer is no. They had been mostly international incidents. Mm-hmm. A lot of them came from Canada, the Vancouver area. A lot of them always ended up, it seemed, in Mexico or Cuba. Mm-hmm. And they were mostly hijacked for political purposes.
Right.
But, you know, people hear the word hijack, and you really... there's not a cookie-cutter definition of hijacking, because they're all done for different reasons, different motivations.
Right.
9/11, their mission was not to live. At this time, most of the people who hijacked aircraft had a political purpose or message they were trying to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was used in a domestic case, in a domestic dispute case, where a man was kidnapping his soon-to-be ex-wife, kind of a trophy wife of sorts,
mm-hmm.
the phrase has been used, and that was just a bridge too far.
And it's quite extraordinary, because you think of domestic disputes. I have never known of one to lead to that type of situation before.
Well, part of his plan, because she was leaving him for his financial ineptitude, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
he had sold several guns of his the Friday before and paid for the charter. He mm-hmm. had also traded in his old car for this new Cadillac. It was actually a used Cadillac, but it was a newer model Cadillac. So he was showing up with a new car. Honey, we're getting in this brand new car. We've got this airplane, this private plane waiting on us. Don't you see you need to come back to me? Everything's going to be fine.
Now, he had been a university professor, right?
That is correct. He was a professor of biology at Peabody, Vanderbilt,
mm-hmm.
and had been there up until early 71.
Wow. I mean, everything is totally out of sync in this whole thing,
yes.
isn't it?
I mean, it, and, you know, people don't realize how small Nashville, Murfreesboro is,
mm-hmm.
and all how so many things interconnect. But some of the people who were involved in this case on the legal side, as well as the actual eyewitnesses, the pilots, a lot of things, it's a small world around here.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't really get that part of it. But after the airplane took off, George Gift decided he wanted to go to Freeport, Bahamas, not Atlanta. My father told him he didn't have enough fuel or the charts or anything to get that far. They were going to have to stop someplace. And at that point, they decided to pick Jacksonville. And once they made that decision, my father radioed ahead over the airplane radio to air traffic control and said, look, we've got an unusual situation. We're going to Jacksonville now. We're going to need charts, fuel. If somebody could help us with a flight plan, that would be great. And ATC came back and said, yeah, we'll comply. We'll have everything ready for you. And then the hijacker, Giff, also told my dad, he goes, I want two bottles of Chavez 12 Scotch. That my father got on the radio and says, Senator, we've got another unusual request, two bottles of Scotch. Now, you got to understand, this is, you know, it's Sunday night,
mm-hmm.
basically. Going to Jacksonville, Florida, no liquor store is going to be open at this hour. So it's kind of a... I think it was telling as far as the unreasonable state of mind that the hijacker Giff was in, as well as Wallace. And just unrealistic expectations of what the outcome is really going to be in this whole thing.
Did it sound to you, and you've been over this thing over and over with all the information that could be possibly given to you, did it seem like they had, Giff had a plan in mind that they were are eventually going to get to and to be able to accomplish?
Well, there are two different schools of thought on that. In some of his luggage that he had put on, left at the airport earlier that day, there were some suicide notes. Mm-hmm. So you can look at those and say, okay, this was his plan. We don't know when they were written. We don't know anything like that. We also know that a lot of Giff's actions indicated after they got on the ground in Jacksonville, up to when the FBI opened fire, and don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, mm-hmm. but up until that moment, this was a man who seemed to be acting in a way that he wanted to live. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of reading the tea leaves on this in a lot of ways, because there were these suicide notes, and at the same time, he was acting in a way where he wanted to survive. So I don't think we've got a definitive answer on that.
His mind's not very well structured right
now. No, it's not. And it's highly emotionally charged. There was lots of fighting and cussing and going on in the back.
His wife's very young.
Yes.
And he's what, kind of?
Well, he was close to 40, and he had been married prior to this marriage mm-hmm. for 16 years, had 3 children. He had left that marriage and those children to marry one of his students at Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. And he wooed her, and somehow they got married. And she kind of figured out after a while that this was not the great businessman that she had kind of pinned her hopes on, in a way.
Right.
And that there were a lot of things wrong in the relationship. It was very volatile. It was very violent. And she had had enough, so she had taken her child and gone back to her parents' house 9 days prior to this event. And during this time, Giff tried and called her several times, sometimes in a day, sometimes, you know, definitely over the week, to try to call her, get her to meet, and get her to come back to him. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't working this time. It simply was not working. She'd had enough.
That's not unusual for those type of domestic relationships.
That's right. Well, you know, and she'd even gone out and gotten a job at a motel, the old King of the Road Motel on Murfreesboro Road as a night clerk. And so she had really planned her life after leaving this man. She wasn't just leaving in some kind of rage or a fit or, you know, high emotionally charged fight. Mm-hmm. There was some planning on her part to be able to survive without George Giff. And that, you know, from all indications, that was just a bridge too far. I mean, he'd left this long-term, stable marriage and all these kids for this woman. She was absolutely gorgeous. And a real prize for him, somebody to take around and show off, mm-hmm. and he got a lot of, you know, congratulatory and adulation from others because of it. And it was just very embarrassing for him and just emotionally too much when she took off.
It's one of those situations that nothing is normal, and there are no previous patterns for this type of situation as it evolves to be able to handle. So you've got what's happened in Nashville.
Yes.
The information has been passed on all the way down to Jacksonville at this time.
Yes.
And the response, I'm sure, is going to be in a situation where people are going to be involved in handling the situation on the ground that probably have never seen anything like this before.
That's true. And you got to keep in mind that at this time, the FBI didn't have SWAT teams or hostage negotiators. That was a concept that was really foreign to everybody except the New York Police Department at that year, and they had only started their first one 2 months prior because of the Attica situation. This was the environment that law enforcement existed at the time, and there was a lot that they didn't know. Some say they didn't want to know. Some have even said that, you know, the old theory of, and we've all seen it in movies, you know, a cop pulls out a badge and says, freeze, I'm with the FBI, and the bad guy just freezes in his tracks and he gets cuffed and taken off. Real life is not that way.
Nope, it's not.
And, you know, if that situation ever did exist, which I highly doubt it ever did, you know, that caricature does not work in a real situation.
Right.
And it was very complex. There were a lot of mistakes made. But you also have to view it through the prism of the era that it happened. And also, I think the Bureau is to be congratulated for, in the years subsequent to that, the advances that they've made in these special teams, especially the hostage negotiators. There's a fellow by the name of Gary Nesner, who was chief negotiator for the FBI for many years. He retired just a couple of years ago. He's a friend of mine. There's a man who not only filled the job of chief negotiator for the FBI, but someone who really studied his craft and wanted to learn as much as he could and also make sure others learned as much as they could who took up that task and saved countless lives because of it.
And that was a period more innocent than what we've got now.
Absolutely.
I mean, you did not have those things happen. So I can't imagine what's running through your dad's mind.
Right.
All the people that are on the plane, and then when they start receiving calls in Jacksonville, the responding agents that are going, they're trying to create something in their minds is what's happening, but they don't have any past experience to go by.
They don't have any past experience, and furthermore, in the precipitous way that the agent in charge in Jacksonville left from his home directly to the airport without, and we've got to remember these are the days before cell phones and all emails and all the wonderful technology we have today. He did not have an FBI radio on him. So he left from his house directly to the airport. And by in doing so, the rest of his team, protocols at the time for the FBI, all the special guys who were going to be called out to a situation first had to go into the Bureau office, pick up their FBI radios, and also pick up any rifles or any other special gear that they had available at the time, and then get dispatched to the scene. Well, their commander for this mission, Assistant Special Agent in Charge James O'Connor called into the office, told the night watchman which special agents he wanted called out, and then drove directly to the airport without any word to anybody. So there was no prior planning. There was no communication with his men about even where to meet at the airport, which became a huge issue. There were several agents that did not show up until the point my father had actually landed and parked on the ramp of the airport. There were only two agents next to the airplane at that moment.
Was there a director of security at the airport at that time?
At Jacksonville International, there was. Protocol at the time was the FBI had total control of a situation, which that rule had only been implemented March of 1970, just a short while before this incident, that anything in the air, if an aircraft was hijacked in the air, it was responsible, the responsibility lied, I should say, with the FAA. Once it touched the ground, it was the responsibility of the FBI.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, not only is Andy going to be able to relate to some of the things that are going on, but you're also going to hear some audio that was the actual happenings at the scene.
It could be any moment the deer of a lifetime walks by, and you have to be prepared. That's why you need to shop Murfreesboro Outdoors.
This is Randy at Murfreesboro Outdoors.
All right, now you hit that one, my boy.
We got camouflage clothes, shotguns, shells, boots, pretty much anything. We got it. If we don't have it, we'll get it.
Murfreesboro Outdoors on Northwest Broad Street, just down from the old International Paper location.
So, what if you're walking out to your car after work and it's been mashed by a runaway garbage truck? We've got an agent for that. Having your own State Farm agent means having a real person there to help you when things go wrong. So when accidents happen, you've got someone you know who will be there when you need them. I'm Jeannie Allman, and I'm that State Farm agent.
Get to a better state, State Farm.
I'm State Farm agent Jeannie Allman at 896-2013.
Southern Community Bank, unlike all the rest. Beverly Barker, branch manager.
Southern Community Bank is a strong, independent community partner with a simple philosophy. Keep banking hassle-free for people who just want to be treated well.
We're unlike all the rest. Our services are intuitive. Our team is friendly. Our approach is refreshing. And our service is clearly unique.
We're located at 1950 Old Fort Parkway, next to the DoubleTree Hotel.
Member FDIC, Equal Housing.
Tennessee Radio Network News, I'm Jim Williams. Republicans say they're confident of adding to their majorities in the legislature tomorrow. Seven Republican incumbents were defeated in the August primary, but the candidates who won there are expected to win the general election. Governor Haslam's already predicting a good night for his party tomorrow, with those legislative majorities becoming super majorities. Democrats hope to hold off the Republicans, at least where they have some advantage in numbers around Nashville. Democrats are in tight races there to hold on to two seats vacated by retiring lawmakers. Republicans are playing defense in a lot fewer races statewide, but Representatives David Hawk of Greenville and John Reagan of Oak Ridge have faced some challenges. Tomorrow at this time, Tennesseans who didn't take advantage of early voting will be casting ballots.
It's the final day before the election. Candidates across the state are working overtime to make every minute count. The clock is ticking for candidates to rally support at the polls, which will open Tuesday at 7 a.m. and close at 7 that evening.
TRN's Tanya J. Powers. And members of a Memphis church are praying for political peace as the election looms. Congregants at Idlewild Presbyterian began their vigil at noon Sunday, signing up to pray at specific times now through Election Day. Mark Jones of the church's peacemaking committee says the prayers are being offered because of what he calls ugliness between parties and candidates. Associate Pastor Margaret Burnett says the prayers are being offered in a nonpartisan way, seeking wise and faithful leadership in government.
If you have a yard or maybe a field, you may plan on digging in it. Perhaps you want to put in a swimming pool, add a super awesome barbecue pit, or bury a comically large chest of pirate booty.
Yarr.
But before you dig, you should know that there are buried pipelines in lots of places, maybe even under your own little patch of St. Augustine. If you dig and hit one of these pipelines, it could cause a leak, and that could cause serious problems.
Sorry.
So before you find buried pipelines with a shovel or a backhoe, find them with a phone. Call 811 before you dig to have any buried lines located and marked at no charge. Remember, before you dig for any reason, be it construction, a sprinkler system, or tunneling your way to sweet, sweet freedom, call 811 first. For more on pipeline safety, visit atmosenergy.com/safety. Brought to you by Atmos Energy.
A man shot to death late Friday night in Montgomery County.
Clarksville police say the shooting happened early Saturday at Sea Rays Social Club in Clarksville. Officers arrived to find a 20-year-old man on a ramp just outside the business with gunshot wounds. He was transported to a hospital where he died.
TRN's Dan Idem. Federal marshals are working with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office to find a missing teen. Volunteers spent the day Sunday looking for 19-year-old Tyler Campbell. He was last seen about 9:30 Saturday night in Fayetteville. And two people are facing charges for allegedly duct taping a pair of Tennessee State students, robbing them at gunpoint in their dorm rooms at Boyd Hall. One of the suspects asked to use one of the victim's phones. Jim Williams, TRN News.
Weather Eye.
We have a slight chance for a developing shower later on, increasing cloud cover, a high of 57, of an east-northeast wind around 5 miles per hour. I'm WGNS staff meteorologist Mandy Valuber. Right now, 43.
That update brought to you by new Airborne Hot Soothing Mix with 14 vitamins, minerals, and herbs, including vitamin C, vitamin A, vitamin E, zinc, and echinacea. New Airborne Hot Soothing Mix, real immune support.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by the Omni Hut Restaurant in Smyrna, AmeriCare Pest Control, and the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS.
I've got pests, bees buzzing, rodents running all through my house, ants chewing wood, and look, there's a mouse. I'm overrun with pests, pests, but you're gonna be sure, safe and secure, it's the last rights for those pests. Call the best of the best to get rid of your pests.
893-7111. AmeriCare Services Incorporated. Call us today. 893-7111.
WGNS, Murfreesboro.
An exciting week ahead. The Young Professionals Summit is coming up this Friday, 8:30 until 4 Friday at the Doubletree Hotel. The fee is $30 for members of the Young Professionals and $50 for non-members. And it all benefits United Way of Rutherford and Cannon Counties. And the Harvest Dance over at the St. Clair Street Senior Center is Friday night at 7. Debbie Bales Trio provides the music. That's Friday night at 7 at the St. Clair Street Senior Center. Chorus Line continues at the Center for the Arts in Uptown Murfreesboro, 7 o'clock Friday and Saturday night, and a Sunday matinee at 2. Over in Woodbury, it's Peter Pan, 7:30 Friday and Saturday night, and a 2 o'clock Sunday matinee. And the Fall Festival is Saturday at Christiana Elementary School. That'll be from 11 to 3. And here's something fun. Swing, celebrating MTSU's School of Music with a dinner and dance at the Stones River Country Club. Quickly, get in touch with MTSU and get tickets for Saturday night's Swing at the Stones River Country Club. Those are Good Neighbor events.
This is Chip Walters, and I'll have Middle Tennessee football and basketball games for you right here.
MTSU Sports on WGNS AM, FM, online.
Now more of The Truman Show with Truman Jones on WGNS AM and FM.
And welcome back with Andy Downs. And when we left, we were still in the plane. We're heading toward Jacksonville.
Heading toward Jacksonville.
The agents have already started to respond.
That's correct.
And I know that things are getting pretty dicey inside the cockpit right now.
That's right. En route to, they were just outside of Jacksonville. We're probably talking about 4 in the morning. Their estimated time of arrival in Jacksonville was 5:10. And somehow you've got to keep in mind that the airplane took off at 2. So the airplane's been in the air for about 2 hours so far. But nobody, through all the mass confusion, had actually notified the Jacksonville field office of the FBI at this time. So it wasn't until 4 o'clock, an hour before roughly when they were supposed to land, that Jacksonville was notified. One of the issues that really complicated matters was people talk about the fog of war.
Mm-hmm.
And when situations start up, and you've got multiple departments and multiple people involved trying to exchange information, and especially in the days of a rotary dial phone,
right,
there was a lot of miscommunication going on, and Jacksonville got a late start to begin with. So when they finally did get the word an hour before the airplane was supposed to be in Jacksonville, the commander, the assistant special agent in charge, Jim O'Connor, was notified and went into the airport directly from his house. Now, protocol was supposed to be everybody go into the FBI office, get all your special equipment, and then run back to the situation location. Mm-hmm. But at this point, that didn't happen. So his men were en route to the FBI office, waiting for their commander, waiting for orders. And when they discovered that, or figured out that their commander was not coming in, they dispatched themselves to the airport. And none of them had a place to meet. No one knew what the plan was. All they knew was that they had a hijacked aircraft that was about to land in Jacksonville.
That's hard to imagine in this day and time.
It really is. And, you know, it created so many problems. The ASAC O'Connor ended up next to a hangar. His first two agents who showed up at the airport went over to the tower. They went into the tower and went up to the cab. And cab is where you can actually look out of the windows, part of the very top of an airport tower, control tower. Looked around, tried to find where their commander was, and made some phone calls and figured out that he was over at this one specific place, which was where my dad's aircraft was supposed to be parking anyway.
So the control tower was basically the control center at that time. The information was.
Yes, because my father could talk to the tower. The FBI didn't have airport radios at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of them still don't. Most law enforcement don't.
Right.
My father could talk to the air traffic control tower, which had an FBI agent in it, with an FBI radio, which he would relay whatever my father said back to the ground commander, and then await the ground commander to tell him what he could relay back to my father. It was a very convoluted setup. You know, I used to do scouting. We used to put a circle of kids together and whisper a sentence in one of them's ear and see if goes around the circle, and it always comes
never
out different.
Correctly.
And that's what you had in this situation. Mm-hmm. You had too many people passing on messages, and none of it was, because I can tell you hello, and if you write that out, hello, or you convey, well, Andy said hello, how I say hello can mean a whole lot more than just the word hello.
Right.
Well, hello. Hello, Truman. Mm-hmm. Two different things.
Right.
And those things are important for a commander to be able to hear and understand as you move forward. But about this time, my father pulled up on the ramp. Another FBI car pulls up on the perimeter of the airport. And one of the first things my father had asked for while en route to Jacksonville was fuel. And my father started asking over the radio where the fuel truck was. Now, this is the days before pilots had headsets in every cockpit. So the speakers to the radio were in the ceiling of the cockpit, which were open to the people in the back. This is only an eight-place aircraft, turboprop aircraft. Luxury aircraft, but small. And so the hijackers could hear the radio once they got on the ground very clearly. And one of the first things that happened was you heard this communication from the FBI.
5-8 November. Yes. 5-8 November, this is the FBI speaking. Cut your engines.
We're going to need some fuel, but I requested everyone to stay away.
advise when your engines have been cut.
And then all hell broke loose basically inside the aircraft, because the hijacker started, Bobby Wayne Wallace was seated right behind my father and pointed his, and had a gun on him. George Giff was in the back with his wife and had his own gun back there. And Wallace and Giff told my father to take off at that point. Just go on and take off. My father said, look, we don't have the fuel.
And the FBI was saying, if they didn't hear it very well, cut your engines off. Are your engines cut off?
Yes.
And he and your dad, in a very calm voice, I must say, for the stress that was going on at that time, was saying, basically, we do need fuel, and no.
That is correct. And the hijacker was threatening to... He also was threatening to blow the aircraft up with some plastic explosives that he said he had on board, along with the guns. Now, the guns were clear to everybody, because that's what motivated everybody to get on the airplane.
Right.
But once they were on the aircraft, he also threatened that he had some plastic explosives in a box with a timer that he'd have to reset every couple of minutes to make sure it did not blow the aircraft up, which assured his being able to live and so on and so forth. But this is where he said he'd blow the aircraft up or kill everybody if my father didn't take off. And it took a lot of guts. I got to tell you, if someone was pointing a gun at me, my father only had 30 minutes of fuel once they hit the Jacksonville. But to sit there and say, you know, if we're going to die taking off, we might as well die here.
Right.
So let's just play it out and see what happens, guys. Calm down. My father turned into his own hostage negotiator by talking this hijacker down several times, and also trying to relay clear information to the FBI, which is, in this next exchange, you're going to hear about my father relaying the information about the plastic explosives that were on board the aircraft. So we'll...
5-8 November.
There you go, and you can hear my father basically trying to get the FBI to bring the fuel truck out there to stay away from the airplane first and foremost.
He's relaying quite clearly the danger that they're in.
Absolutely. He's very clear about, you know, the dangers, like you said, and trying to maintain a calm, cool presence in the aircraft.
And he did.
Because inside that airplane, you had Giff screaming and threatening, and Wallace doing the same thing, as well as Giff's wife, who was in and out of hysterics, anywhere between hysterical and lethargic at times, as it was described. And it was a very emotional scene on board. At this point, my father is able to talk to the main hijacker, after it's pretty clear that they're not going to have any fuel brought out to them. My father was able to negotiate with the hijacker into allowing someone off the airplane.
Which is extraordinary.
Which is absolutely unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to calm him down. So the hijacker went from threatening to kill everybody to allowing somebody off the airplane. Now, to get from one emotional state to the next, for any negotiator, professional or otherwise, is a big feat. Especially when you're not the objective negotiator, you're the one with the gun to your head. So he was able to get this accomplished, and he allowed the co-pilot off the aircraft. Wallace, at this point, my father first started to get out of his seat when Giff agreed that somebody could leave and go talk to the FBI. And at that point, Wallace pointed his gun at my father and said, no, the captain stays. And that's how the co-pilot got off.
Right.
And after the co-pilot got off, there's a clip that we'll play about the co-pilot stays. I believe is what it is labeled. Probably two or three down from where we were. Co-pilot's in the car. So let's hear what the
situation. U.S. attorney and police order prosecutors their planes because they take care of experience. Craig got the most well-earned experience. It was a size case, up highly potent, and he took over. The judge said it was limited. Prosecution, the worst plane in his he'd ever seen on the bench. 42 years.
Was in handcuffs at the time.
Yes, at this moment, the when this message is being relayed, they had just cuffed and put the co-pilot in the back of the FBI car. Mm-hmm. And the co-pilot was trying to explain to the FBI agents that these guys, this was a real situation, this wasn't a joke, these guys had guns, one of them was threatening a bomb, they were, they'd already threatened to kill him once or twice, you've got to listen to me.
And he's crying and emotional.
He's very emotional, he is crying, and they put him in the back of the car and said, you sit back there and shut up, we've got this under control. This is a bunch of malarkey. We've got this under control. And then something even more remarkable happens. My father's able to talk to Giff to allow, or my father actually kind of suggested that, well, why don't one of y'all get out and go check on the co-pilot and see if y'all can get it fixed? And
this is where it really turns unreal.
Oh, I know. It turns just absolutely bizarre at this point. Well, at this point, Wallace decides he's going to get out. Mm-hmm. This wasn't as much fun as he thought it would be at the very beginning, but gets out with his pistol tucked in his waistband and walks over to the FBI. And, of course, they take the gun away from him, cuff him, put him on the ground. And at that moment, as soon as they cuff him on the ground, put him spread eagle down on the ramp, Agent O'Connor orders his men to open fire on my father's aircraft.
Mm.
It wasn't but just a couple of seconds after that. And so you had, as these FBI agents trailed in, kind of trickled into the scene, at this point you had about four near the aircraft. Well, all four open fire on the airplane, trying to shoot at the tires and the engines of the aircraft. And the agent in charge, actually, while one of his agents is shooting at the airplane, runs over to the nose holding a rifle and tries to look in the windshield of the aircraft. Mm. Now, he's, you know, it kind of reminded me of a Quentin Tarantino movie where everybody shot each other at the same time. Yeah. Because he was in direct line of fire, and yet he's running into the line of fire to go take a peek into the windshield. For what purpose that would serve, I'm not sure. But as soon as that agent picked up, got right in the front field of view of the aircraft, looked in that windshield holding that rifle, Giff shot out of that windshield twice.
Mm.
And he missed him. And then other agents start trickling into the scene where they're all surrounding the aircraft. They're literally walking. Four agents are walking around the airplane at different angles, some clockwise, some counterclockwise, but they're all taking turns shooting at the tires and the right engine that was still running on the aircraft. And at this moment, Giff inside opens fire in the aircraft, shooting my father, his wife three times, and then taking his own life. Mm. And that's how it ended up.
It's a clear case of something happening without the proper information, the proper training.
Yes.
And, you know, and you can look back at it, and there have been a lot of positive things that have come out of this.
Absolutely.
I mean, you have taken it upon yourself. You're one of the trainers who travels, and you deal with law enforcement agencies on how to handle negotiations, how to handle these situations. The FBI had utilized that to upgrade their ability to deal with hijackers and in all types of negotiations in that situation. It's just a shame. But your dad, I was listening to this one and some of the other audio off of that. It's unbelievable how he was able to handle the situation as clearly as he did.
Yes.
He did not let the emotions of fear or anything else override his ability to assess the situation. And it sounded like he was keeping everybody calm up to a point.
Up to the best of his ability and to the fullest extent he could, that is absolutely true. You know, there's an interesting statistic. I've been able to research a lot about hijackings. And there's a place called Stanton University that has put together a collection of information on every hijacking that's taken place in the world. There's never been a situation where a captain of an aircraft that was hijacked has ever made a decision that cost the life of someone.
That's amazing.
And when you think about it, think about Captain Sully, who landed in the Hudson not too long ago, mm-hmm. You know, and everybody was so amazed at how calm and cool he was going in talking about landing in a river. You can find all kinds of clips of pilots in emergency situations all over the place on the internet, YouTube and other places. It is almost unheard of for that captain of that craft to be out of control, auditory-wise or emotional or anything else, because they know and they are trained that you deal with the facts, not emotions. You have to compartmentalize all these things to properly handle the situation. And it was just a textbook case of grace under pressure.
You know, you could also, and I know you may already be doing this, but you could do a lot of training with the airline industry dealing with the passengers on how to handle situations, because,
that's right,
you know, they're the ones that are more liable to become unglued and start screaming and all that other stuff.
Exactly. And we've done a lot. I've been able to talk to airline unions, aviation universities, MTSU, Florida Institute of Technology, and Jacksonville University all have large aviation school programs. And we've been able to go down and talk to them a lot about that. And, you know, so it's a subject that's of great interest to those who are going to be up and coming and tomorrow's pilots. It's also a situation where the law enforcement community, especially the hostage negotiators, have really taken me in so many ways and allowed me to travel around the country and share this story with them, because, and what we probably going to be running out of time to get to, but the result of this legal case, mm-hmm. which, you know, again, we've not but about 4 minutes left. We've got 10 minutes. My apologies. I just gave away a radio secret. Somebody flashed me 10, and, you know, I just busted that's the radio illusion of the radio process, I guess. My mother filed a wrongful death suit against the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover right after this. The FBI had never lost in court before. They had never lost a civil action of any type as long as J. Edgar Hoover had created that agency and really built it up to what it was at that point. And it was a 4-year, almost 5-year legal battle. But my mother took on the Bureau, and for the first time in U.S. history, a U.S. citizen actually won a wrongful death and negligence case against the FBI, which was groundbreaking in itself, for a lot of subsequent cases. But that case, Downs versus USA, was the legal precedent that made the FBI start its first hostage negotiation team. And one of the great things that the FBI does to this day is they take the core programs of their special teams and they send their representatives out to other law enforcement agencies, whether it's sheriff, police, local, state, mm-hmm. all types. And they help train the special teams on those other departments nationwide. And they also have classes and schools at Quantico and other places where, you know, the law enforcement community can come up and do special classes and special training. Then they come back to the communities, just like in Murfreesboro. You know, the Murfreesboro police and the sheriff, Rutherford County, they've got a lot of highly trained people that go out and take these classes. They're negotiators. They're SWAT team members. They're bomb squad members. Mm-hmm. All these people go out and take this highly specialized training that actually prevent these type of situations from getting out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that, you know, and of course, budget issues are all over the place these days, but I think the public needs to keep in mind that the reason we don't see more of the situations that my father was in whether it's a standoff in your own neighborhood or in some kind of robbery or something like this, is because your community invests its human resources into getting very specialized training to defuse and de-escalate these very emotional situations. And that's why you don't see a lot of these out-of-control cases in our own backyard, is because our community and the leaders and the sheriff, you know, Captain Spence is one of them over there at the sheriff's department, mm-hmm. you know, he makes sure his people get trained. And they're trained well, and they not only keep us safe, but they keep things from getting out of control. And that is, a lot of times, more critical than any other aspect of it.
It's the most important, too, that you have now. I've come from the days of where there was no training, and then they developed the post and then the training academy and all of that. And it's an entirely different world now. And if you're not able to go forward and deal with all the issues of the changing world, you're going to be left behind.
You are.
And what you're saying is totally correct. I mean, it used to be you wanted to hit the situation, get it over with, and then come back. Now, you can't do that anymore because your dad is one of the main reasons right now why training has improved so much. You can deal better. You can save lives in a situation now where in the past they were just going to be a victim of the situation.
That's right.
And you kept hearing 58 November.
Yes.
That was your dad's aircraft.
That's right. That was the call sign or the tail number of my father's airplane, and it's also the title of the documentary that I'm putting together for PBS. And 58 November, and I also use it in the lectures with law enforcement. It's kind of become a rallying cry for, you know, let's take a deep breath and think about this, guys, for law enforcement, and also give us a lot of up-and-coming pilots and current pilots something to think about if they ever find themselves in those situations.
Was there anything audio just before the Bureau charged the plane?
Yes.
There was audio of what was going on, the order to assault?
Yes. One of the things that was interesting in the audio tapes that I was able to get from the National Archives, the FBI agent in the tower had an open mic.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means, ladies and gentlemen, he had an airport radio microphone in front of him that he pushed a button to talk in. Mm-hmm. But what he didn't know how to do was mute it. So while he was talking to my father, he would also have to relay this information on his FBI radio down to the commander on the ground, and then wait for the commander to send those orders back up. And we've got these background conversations on tape now. which are really fascinating. And, you know, little sound bites like, my God, it sounds like there's a war going on down there, was one of them that really struck me. And you get a different viewpoint of what the chaos was truly like, because there's a lot of talking over each other. There's a lot of people trying to talk on the radio at the same times over the FBI radios, trying to coordinate, if you can really call it that, or come up with a game plan on how to handle this situation. And you can hear more I don't knows than any orders. And they didn't know how much fuel. They didn't know how much at one point.
Yeah.
They didn't know, you know, where they may take off next, which is a big conversation in the background. And you hear a lot of these chaotic background chatter that these FBI agents were debating how to fix the situation. It's fascinating. It really is.
Even with all the training, every hijacking is different, and it's done for a different motive.
Yes.
And when you have, I can't imagine being one of the negotiators on a situation where the hijackers are politically motivated, where they have prisoners that they're trying to get out, they're trying to swap innocent bystanders for some of the political prisoners that are currently incarcerated. And of course, you know, you can't deal with that. I mean, it's an impossibility.
It is.
And I'm sure that you cover every scenario that you can possibly think about when you do about it, but there's always going to be something new.
There's always going to be something new. And one of the fallacies that I believe that are in the system to this day is that since post 9/11, every hijacking now is viewed by law enforcement as somebody flying into some tower somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's simply not the case. And we've got evidence of that post 9/11 of several hijackings throughout the world that, and luckily we haven't had one here, but there have been several in Italy and Turkey and France and Russia and other places, that the goal of the hijacker was not to self-destruct. It was for these political reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, when you think about the possibilities of, you know, a man being hijacked and up in the air, you know, they're not calling those fighter jets out just to say hello up there.
Yeah.
There's some really tough decisions that have been forced upon some people in a legal framework that they're not allowed to operate outside of. And I think that's something that really needs to be addressed in the future, and something that I talk about a lot on the road to law enforcement.
Now, you're going to have some things that are going to be on television and some other places coming up.
Yes.
And I think 58 November is going to be the prime title, and that's simply because of your dad and his airplane.
That's right. It'll be 58 November. You can go to the web, look up 58 November, and you can see some of the work we've already done as far as interviews of eyewitnesses. We've brought a lot of people together. I found original FBI agents who were actually on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
The judge who overheard the Bobby Wayne Wallace air piracy trial, which is something we really haven't had a chance to get into, but Wallace just died a couple of weeks ago while walking to the Vanderbilt Auburn game.
Wow.
Dropped dead in the parking lot.
That's hard to believe he got out of jail.
You know, it's hard to believe he got acquitted, but he did.
You're kidding.
Dead serious. And there's a whole story behind that that is another show, because in all these FBI...
You're saying acquitted. You mean entirely found and innocent.
Absolutely.
That is unbelievable.
Jim Neal, a famous defense attorney,
one of the best,
defended him and was actually able to get him acquitted. Now, he had a lot of lucky things happen too, but you can't deny his skills. But 3 days before the trial, the U.S. attorney in Jacksonville decided he would first chair the case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are U.S. attorneys who are trial attorneys, but for the most part, they're administrators. They give orders, just like a police chief or a or a sheriff to their frontline men to take care of a situation. Mm-hmm. And U.S. attorneys order their prosecutors to take care of things because they got the most experience, current experience. Well, it was a highly publicized case. He took over and blew it. The judge said it was the worst prosecution he'd ever seen in his 42 years on the bench.
I don't know how anybody could leave a courtroom and feel good about anything when something like that happens. And you can't think, how in the world could anybody who reaches a level being a federal attorney could make that type of mistake? Because you can always kind of like recusing yourself. You can let somebody else come in there that had the experience.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Ego gets us more than often in life.
Yeah. Andy, it's been a great being with you, and I hope we can get back again.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot that we haven't covered.
There's a whole lot, and I'll be glad to come back anytime you want.
I'll be calling you, and good luck in taking care of all these law enforcement officers. They need it.
Thank you much, and yes, they do, and they deserve our respect.
Yes, they do. And we'll see you in the morning at 9 o'clock, and we'll have Mr. Greg Tucker on.